From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and this is Fresh Air. We gave Terry Gross the day off, but not before we got a couple of interviews out of her. Coming up, we'll hear her conversation with cartoon historian Steve Schneider on the origins of some of Hollywood's most beloved stars, Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, and Daffy Duck. Schneider's written a history of the Warner Brothers Animation Studios. Also, a look at the new film Say Anything, written and directed by Cameron Crowe, who wrote the screenplay for Fast Times at Ridgemont High. We'll hear the first of a two-part interview Terry recorded with Cameron Crowe, and we'll find out what critic Stephen Schiff thinks of the film. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from some of the new women of country music. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air.
In fairness, I must warn those with weak constitutions to leave the theater for this performance. Lights? Thank you. Some appropriate music, maestro? Thank you.
The immodest Daffy Duck was one of the stars of the Warner Brothers cartoons. Warner Brothers Animation specialized in irreverent comedy. Their celebrity roster also included Bugs Bunny, Porky Pig, Elmer Fudd, Sylvester the Cat, Tweety Bird, Pepe Le Pew, Yosemite Sam, Foghorn Leghorn, Wile E. Coyote, and the Roadrunner. In the 1930s and 40s, audiences saw the Warners' Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies at movie theaters. In the 1950s and 60s, children grew up with them on TV. My guest Steve Schneider is the author of That's All Folks, A History of the Warner Brothers Cartoon Stars and the Writers, Animators, and Actors Who Created Them. Schneider has written about animation for the New York Times and the Village Voice and is a former TV columnist for the Times. In 1985, he was the guest curator for an exhibition saluting the Warner Brothers Animation Studio at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Schneider told me what makes the Warner Brothers cartoons different from the rest.
Well, both specifically and in general, I think it's a spirit of irreverence. The Warner Studio sort of hit its glory after the Disney Studio had been established. And if you know, Disney is sort of saccharine and storybooks and fairy tale lands, and things are always rounded and cute and so on. Warner's was a very direct sense of reaction to that. The studio never had the kinds of physical resources that the Disney shop did in terms of the amount of money or the amount of time that they could devote to their films. And not only that, the Warner Studio, the live-action divisions, was the site of where Bogart and Cagney were making their great movies in the 30s and 40s. So what the Warner cartoonists were virtually forced to do was to come up with cleverer or wittier films, and also they sort of kept within the signature style of the studio by making it this kind of street-smart and snappy kind of humor. In particular, they were virtually thumbing their nose at the Disney traditions throughout. The way they played with film forms, the way the characters were kind of, again, street smart.
Urban and ethnic, it seemed, too, that there was always an urban ethnic streak to the character.
Exactly. In particular, as a good example, there's a Disney cartoon which is called Lullaby Land, which seems to sort of sum up the Disney sensibility. That's from the 1930s. Well, by the 1940s, the Warner folks could release a film called Bowery Bugs, and it's much a good encapsulation of the difference between the two.
Well, let's look at some of the stars of the Warner Brothers cartoons and go through their characterizations and who developed them and how they changed over the years. Why don't we start with the first big star of this particular group of cartoons, and that's Porky Pig. Now, he made his debut in 1935 in a cartoon that was directed by Fritz Fehling called I Haven't Got a Hat. And I want to play a short clip of this, and our listeners who know Porky Pig will see how different the character was, will hear how different the character was when he was originated. And in this, he's like a school kid, fat, self-conscious, with a stutter. And here he is in school, and by the way, the teacher is a cow.
We will now open our exercises with a recitation by our little friend, Porky Pig.
Listen, my children, and you shall hear the midnight ride of Paul Revere.
That's almost uncomfortable to listen to. It sounds like a real stutter.
Absolutely. In fact, it was. Porky came along as part of a whole group of schoolroom characters. He was not intended to be the bearer of this great star awaits, you know. And the first voice that they got for it was a man by the name of Joe Dougherty. This is during the days before Mel Blanc, who's synonymous with so many of the Warner voices, had come in. In order to give the character a kind of distinctiveness, director Freeling had a character actor named Dougherty come and do the voice. Well, in fact, he had a genuine stutter. And eventually that became such a problem because they would take so much time in recording the things, he couldn't control his delivery at all. He would get stuck on words and they'd have to do take after take after take. Finally, they canned him, and they had Mel Blanc come in and devise a more caricatured version of what a pig's delivery would be. And in fact, I agree with you. The early versions of Porky, the voice is almost painful to listen to because you really get a sense of the poor fellow suffering there.
Yeah, and in the cartoon, he's sweating bullets.
Exactly.
So as the voice changed, how did the characterization of Porky Pig change?
Well, the Warner folks, the cartoonists, were actually a bit surprised when they finally came up with a character that caught on in any kind of massive way. So they retooled the character virtually from cartoon to cartoon. He would change his entire appearance and even his entire identity, not only changing roles from film to film, but he would be an adult, he'd be an infant, he'd be a farmer, he'd be a city slicker. It would all be changed. Finally, I think he hit his kind of classic form around 1937 when a director named Bob Clampett took over one of the units there. There were usually three or four separate units making cartoons in tandem at Warner Brothers. And Clampett had an early assignment for working with Porky and the Looney Tunes. He redesigned the character quite attractively, I believe, and also worked with Mel Blanc to come up with a voice which was humorous rather than agonizing.
How was it Porky Pig who got to do That's All Folks? How did he get the assignment?
Well, a variation...
And I should say That's All Folks is the verbal logo that ended all the Looney Tunes.
Right. A variation on that began as early as the audition reel that the early Warner cartoonist put together in 1929. That very first reel, which was never released to the public, ended with a character saying, "So long, folks." And that just metamorphosed over the course of years. And when Porky became popular, especially with his very, very distinctive vocal sonority, they just assumed it was a catchy and memorable way to end the films.
Well, Porky Pig was eventually eclipsed by some of his co-stars. And you point out in your new book that each new star debuted as a supporting character. And that's how Daffy Duck got his start. He got his start as a supporting character in a Porky Pig cartoon. So why don't we look at Daffy Duck next? And my guest, by the way, is Steve Schneider, author of the new book, That's All Folks, The Art of Warner Brothers Animation. Let's introduce Daffy Duck by listening to his voice. And this is from a 1946 cartoon called Daffy Doodles. And in this cartoon, Daffy Duck has taken on the fiendish mission of drawing mustaches on every billboard in town.
We've all got a mission in life. We get into different ruts. Some are the cogs on the wheels. Others are just plain nuts. I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild about me. Science is some folks' calling. Others pilot a ship. My mission in life, stated simply, is a mustache on every lip.
I have to tell you, Daffy Duck was always one of my favorite characters. He was such the con artist and such the always bluffing his way through everything.
Exactly. I mean, he began really as the flightiest and the kind of most footloose of them all, but gradually became more inwardly directed. He was a creature really responding to a kind of set of neuroses, which was unused to being present in animated cartoons. I mean, he became self-serving and greedy and egotistical at the same time as he would always set himself up for failure. And again, as in, I think, the Roadrunner cartoons, which came later, it's a relationship between desire and failure that motivates so many of the Warner comic underdogs, like the Coyote and also Daffy Duck. Daffy, I think, had about the most protean existence of all the characters there. For some reason, most of the directors, certainly all of the stronger directors, Tex Avery, Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, a couple of the others, found in Daffy, I think, perhaps their most receptive vehicle. They would refashion him virtually from picture to picture, and he became perhaps the strongest statement of their individual temperaments as filmmakers. He was uncontrollably flighty, say, in Tex Avery's films. Then when Bob Clampett came along, he became just almost a volcano of energy, which is the way that Clamp had handled a lot of his films.
Do you know how Mel Blanc developed the sputtering voice for him?
Well, one story has it that it was actually a takeoff of boss Leon Schlesinger's speech. Schlesinger had a lisp, and they were trying to come up with some kind of way to add a little bit of a zing to this otherwise, you know, anonymous duck at the point. And someone suggested that they impersonate Schlesinger's voice. And they did that very early on, and Daffy's duck, Daffy's voice, like many of the others, was sped. So the lisp there, the sputter actually was engendered by Schlesinger's lisp. And then, according to legend, when Schlesinger first heard the Daffy voice, he fell on the floor loving it and not knowing the fact it was a gentle piece of ridicule against Mr. Big there. So.
Now, Daffy Duck in many cartoons was hunted by Elmer Fudd. That was also the fate of Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny was also hunted by Elmer Fudd. Elmer Fudd was not very bright, always getting conned by Bugs and Daffy. Let's hear a clip of Elmer Fudd's voice, and this is from a 1952 cartoon called Rabbit Seasoning.
It's wabbit season. Oh, boy, wabbit twax. Oh, White Wabbit, I know you're there. If you're not out in 10 seconds, I'll blast you out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10... Okay, Wabbit, now I got you.
What's up, Doc?
I'm hunting wabbits. It's wabbit season.
The voice of Elmer Fudd is one of the few voices that wasn't done by Mel Blanc.
Yeah, in fact, it's the only really long-ranging voice that Mel didn't handle, outside of some of the female ones. It was done by a radio actor named Arthur Q. Bryan, who was a pudgy dumpling of a man, who was freelancing in radio in various and sundry capacities, and he had this voice, and this seemed to be the definitive milksop, you know, the all-purpose schmo that someone like Bugs Bunny could play off of, and so they seized upon it immediately.
I've always thought of Elmer Fudd as being the square in the cartoons, also the stupid authority figure, the authority figure who was always conned by the other characters.
Yeah, exactly. He's a kind of the all-purpose dimwit aggressor. You know, some people have, over the years, kind of raised some hackles about the allegedly violent content of these cartoons. And let's face it, Fudd might be an example of this because he's always coming after someone with a rifle, or at least in his most prototypical occasions. And if you think about it, in every single one of Warner cartoons, the aggressor is always the one who loses. I mean, it has a kind of anti-violent attitude in a strange sense. If you get too heavy, firstly, you're made to look ridiculous because you're such a sap, in the case of Fudd, or so flustery and so blustery like Yosemite Sam. The morale here is that antagonism never pays off in these films. You always get your just desserts from someone who is sharper or wittier or more resourceful than you are.
The character of Elmer Fudd evolved from an earlier character called Egghead. Who was this character? I don't think I've ever seen any Egghead cartoons.
Yeah, Egghead crept around in about a half a dozen films in the late 30s. He was introduced in a Tex Avery cartoon called Egghead Rise Again in 1937, and he was a very, very highly caricatured kind of fellow with a big bulbous nose and a kind of sloshy voice. His voice often impersonated a very popular 30s comedian named Joe Penner, and his attire often was that of another nightclub comic named Ben Blue. But he was a little too bizarre to really catch take root, really. And you can actually see him almost metamorphose into Elmer in a film called Elmer's Candid Camera.
Let's move on to the Warner Brothers superstar, and that's Bugs Bunny, their great song and dance man. And to introduce the voice of Bugs Bunny, let's go to one of the great parodies of the Warner Brothers cartoons. This is a parody of Wagner's Ring Cycle, and this is called What's Opera, Doc? And the plot, of course, is Elmer Fudd hunting Bugs Bunny, but it's all done in opera.
Oh, mighty warrior of great fighting stock, might I inquire to ask him, what's up, Doc?
I'm going to kill the wabbit.
Oh, mighty hunter, twill be quite a task. How will you do it, might I inquire to ask?
I will do it with my spear and magic helmet.
Your spear and magic helmet?
Spear and magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Bugs Bunny was really the great vaudevillian, the great opera star, the great song and dance man of the Warner Brothers cartoons. How did he get that kind of entertainment, Mr. Entertainment personality?
Well, I just think that he was a creature of infinite flexibility and essentially...
He was talented.
Yeah, I mean, before long, he was all bunnies to all people. Before long, they just had him do everything, and there was always a new context for him. I just think that his braggadocio or his shamelessness or just, you know, the brightness of his smile motivated the cartoonist to put him in these kinds of contexts.
It was funny, you know, I was watching a lot of the cartoons last night, and there were so many cartoons, including the one we just heard an excerpt of, in which Bugs Bunny disguises himself by appearing in drag and trying to do the sexual tease on whichever hunter is hunting him.
Yeah, almost from his very first film, that's a bit of the bunny shtick. Again, it's because, well, as I mentioned, it's almost like he has no weight of a self. He can do virtually anything. He's quicker than Groucho and tougher than Cagney at the same time. And I think going in drag was, you know, the cartoons were always sort of ghettoized or never really considered mainstream artworks in their own way. And this way, at the very, very margins of the movie world, these guys were able to get away with some subversive images or ideas that were just neglected. The only way that it was possible is that these things were so ignored for so long that they carved out a little niche of freedom for themselves.
You have a great quote from Mel Blanc, who did the voice for Bugs Bunny. You say that, Mel Blanc says that he knew that Bugs Bunny was supposed to be a tough little stinker, so he gave him a combination of a Brooklyn and a Bronx accent, because he figured those were all the tough people he knew were from Brooklyn or the Bronx. Was Bugs Bunny always such the wise guy? Did he start off that way?
Well, in fact, the character did evolve, but rather gradually and rather subtly compared to some of the others. Very early on, he was quite clearly a sort of rabbit clone of Daffy Duck. In his first films, he would just madly hurl himself around a forest and put together all kinds of wisecracks and all kinds of other gambits which are largely unmotivated. A couple of years before the first Bugs cartoon, Daffy had come along and caused a bit of an explosion in the theaters. Well, what do you do? Same thing in Hollywood these days, sequel mania. One of the directors there, he said he would just put a rabbit suit on that duck. And that, I think, might be the relationship between them. But then gradually, in 1940, Tex Avery directed a cartoon which I really think crystallized the Bugs character. That's called A Wild Hare. And all of this kind of scampering lunacy and the flightiness was shaved away. And he became someone who did virtually the opposite of overreacting to all situations. And no matter what his threat, he would always sort of stand there and stare someone down. He became a creature who initiated action rather than reacted to it, and established an almost immediate psychological control over his antagonists, no matter how much firepower they were pointing at him.
How did "What's up, Doc" become his motto?
A couple of theories on this. I think the most plausible one is it was just a phrase from Tex Avery's youth when he was growing up in Texas. They gave it to the character accidentally or randomly, and the reaction was so strong from that very first moment that they stuck with it. Again, Avery has a quote, and he said, you know, audience were expecting the character to scream or do anything outside of come up with an understated remark. And then they said, boy, we'll do that every chance we got. And they did.
I want to talk with you more about cartoons, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Steve Schneider, author of the new book, That's All Folks, The Art of Warner Brothers Animation. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about the Warner Brothers cartoons, and my guest Steve Schneider is the author of a new book on the subject. He also was guest curator for an exhibition saluting the Warner Brothers Animation Studio at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 1985. There were two different kinds of Warner Brothers cartoons. One was called The Merry Melodies and the other was called Looney Tunes. What was the difference between each?
Well, they, in fact, were two separate series being produced by the same unit, as it were, way back when. But then the difference eventually folded. The Looney Tunes were the first series, Begun in 1930 by the pioneering cartoonists at Warner Brothers. That's Hugh Harmon, Rudolph Ising, and Friz Freleng. And they originally starred a character called Bosco. These were in black and white cartoons and are not in very wide distribution these days. The Looney Tunes were so popular that Warner Brothers came to them and asked them to start a second series called The Merry Melodies. Warner Brothers was distributing these films, whereas Harmon and Ising, under producer Leon Schlesinger, were making them. Eventually, the Looney Tunes became the arena for the Warner's featured characters, Bosco, then when Bosco was out, replaced by Buddy, then eventually Porky Pig, who was the first Warner star known these days, became the star of the Looney Tunes series. The Merry Melodies were more specifically related to music. Each one of those early cartoons, again beginning in 1931, had to have a musical number in it that was based on music owned by Warner Brothers, either from one of its feature films or from one of its sheet music publishing concerns. And so for about 8 or 9 years, the Merry Melodies were explicitly musical films. They would have no continuing characters. These are all the cartoons with the singing bugs and the singing laundry and so on.
Yeah.
And those were also the first ones to be made in color with the Merry Melodies. Eventually, though, those distinctions were largely eroded. By around 1940, the Merry Melodies and the Looney Tunes were kind of interchangeable, although the last black and white films were the Looney Tunes, and they went as far forward as 1943. At 1943, the two series became indistinguishable. Star characters were in both series, and they just held on to the names out of the value of tradition, or to perhaps create an illusion that they had two separate series.
They each had different themes. Maybe we can play the music for each theme and you could tell us the origin of the theme. Let's start with the Merry Melodies theme. Now, that's a re-recording of the theme that's available now on an anthology called TV Tunes. Where did the theme come from? Who chose it?
Okay, that was chosen by Warner Brothers cartoon music director, the name of Carl Stalling. He joined the shop in 1936, and it's a piece called Merrily We Roll Along, which was a popular tune which had been featured in a movie around the time. Stalling also chose the theme for the Looney Tunes, which is called The Merry-Go-Round Broke Down. Stalling had been an early associate of Walt Disney back in Kansas City, where many of these cartoonists began. And he came to Hollywood on Disney's request, worked with Disney for a while on some of the first Silly Symphonies, knocked around a couple of other studios, then came to Warner Brothers, where he was their music director for about 22 years, did, to my mind, a series of brilliant scores, musical pastiches, which combined snatches of popular tunes and classical music, as well as snippets of his own compositions, as well as some original songs as well.
Let's listen to the theme that Stallings chose for the Looney Tunes. And this was originally a kind of jazz pop novelty tune called The Merry-Go-Round Broke Down. And this is, again, a re-recording of it. Those cartoons use such hip music.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Really, you know, Stalling also is being rediscovered by an entire generation of downtown New York avant-garde composers because of the syncopations of his music, mm-hmm. the evocativeness of the instrumentation, and just the entire very sort of rapidly cutting textures and things that he would put together to complement the action from scene to scene.
I think the great cartoon characters who we've been discussing kind of died out in the 60s?
Well, most of the Warner stars had their last releases in the 60s. Bugs Bunny's last cartoon was issued in 1964, when what is generally accepted to be the Warner cartoon shop closed down. It closed in about 1963.
Why did it close?
A variety of factors, almost all of them economic. The double feature had become a thing of the past in movie theaters, and cartoons like travelogues and newsreels were part of the fairly baroque film programs that used to lure people into theaters during all those years. The rise of television, which created a whole new market and a new aesthetic for animation, using limited animation and so on, and the fact that there was just very little marketing ability, I think, for these cartoons in theaters. They didn't think that they were economically worthwhile. at that point. Mm-hmm. But then soon thereafter, the shop opened again. They changed gears, and the studio under DePatie Freeling Enterprises made a couple of dozen cartoons, mostly starring Daffy Duck and Speedy Gonzales. And then, lo and behold, in 1967, the studio, known corporately as Warner Brothers Cartoons, started up again. And that's when they introduced such characters as Cool Cat and Merlin the Magic Mouse. These were all for theatrical release again. And those finally breathed their last in 1969.
Do you think of cartoons as being the American pop form of surrealism?
Well, kind of in the same way that Bugs could go into drag because he was given given a little bit of leeway being a sort of marginal figure. In the same way, the cartoonist could also craft images that approach a kind of simple surrealism, yes. It is because they didn't have the rigid constraints of what I suppose could be considered Hollywood classicism to bind them down. You know, so many of the Hollywood movies fall into the same kinds of narrative tendencies with straightforward storylines and a simple three-act structure and so on. Well, the Warner cartoons, because they were comedic, because they were non-realistic, often played with time and with spatial images and with so on and so forth. So yeah, this was a tiny outpost of surrealism in mainstream American cinema.
How did you start taking cartoons seriously, studying them, I think collecting them as well?
Yeah, involuntarily. I had loved them as a kid and watched them quite relentlessly. Then I went through a latency phase when I thought I had outgrown these things. Then, back in 1975, there was a retrospective of the work of Warner Animation director Chuck Jones in New York. I attended it. And just got reacquainted with, well, it just confirmed what I had suspected that when I was younger, that in so many of the cases, these are masterly films, despite any qualifications, that they're supposed to be humorous, that they're supposed to be for kids. Well, that's all irrelevant. The artistry, and in many cases, the absolute brilliance of these films still speaks through to adult audiences. So I became reacquainted at a fairly august retrospective being held in New York in 1975.
What do you look to now for the future of cartoons?
Well, there are some interesting possibilities. I'm not quite as enthusiastic about computer animation as many people are, but I think with the advent of Roger Rabbit, which has been popular, kind of the classic forms might be rekindled. And also Warner Brothers, since 1969, has had a very, very capable and interested and caring man in charge of the cartoon division by the name of Ed Blyer, who's now the head of their television division. He has quite conscientiously and thoughtfully work with the artists who are still around and with the characters to be able to give them a new life, to in effect reinvent them for the 80s. And I think he's doing an admirable job with it.
Is there a cartoon that you saw a lot as a child that has always been among your favorites?
Absolutely, of course. It is called The Great Piggy Bank Robbery from 1946 by the brilliant Bob Clampett. It is the one where Daffy Duck conks himself on the head with an excess of enthusiasm after receiving his Dick Tracy comic book, and he hallucinates himself to be Duck Twacy, and then he encounters a slew of absolutely bizarro monsters in some of the most shocking and memorable scenes, I think, in all of movie history. That is a tremendous sentimental favorite. Another one is Chuck Jones's Duck Amuck, which came a little bit later, which is not as wild and woolly and anarchic as the Clampett film, but seems much more intellectual and disciplined. And if pressed, I would say that Duck Amuck is the finest one-reel film ever made of any kind, and I think it is a supportable argument.
Steve Schneider, thanks so much for talking with us about cartoons. Thank you.
Steve Schneider's book, That's All, Folks, The Art of Warner Brothers Animation, is published by Henry Holt. He spoke with Fresh Air host Terry Gross. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry today, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Terry will speak with journalist Ben Bradley, Jr. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe and author of the book Guts and Glory, The Rise and Fall of Oliver North. Bradley's book has been made into a TV miniseries that will air on CBS April 30th and May 2nd. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. I'm sitting in today for Terry Gross, who returns to the office tomorrow. Coming up, the first of a two-part interview Terry recorded with Cameron Crowe. Crowe spent a year posing as a high school senior, gathering material for his book, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Now Crowe's taken another look at high school in his new movie, Say Anything. Film critic Stephen Schiff has seen Say Anything. He shares his views of the film and of Cameron Crowe's directorial debut. And Ken Tucker samples new albums from a quartet of female country vocalists. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The remains of the 47 sailors killed on the battleship Iowa arrived today at a military morgue in Dover, Delaware. Secretary of the Navy William Ball was on hand for ceremonies honoring the men who died yesterday in an explosion inside a gun turret during firing exercises. As the Iowa steamed toward home port in Norfolk, Virginia, for repairs, a team of naval investigators went aboard to begin the task of determining what caused the accident. NPR's David Malpas reports.
The investigators face a difficult job because none of the eyewitnesses to the explosion in the top section of the gun turret survived. A former captain of the Iowa says those who operate the big 16-inch guns are the cream of the crop, constantly drilled in safety procedures. Although the gunpowder bags that ignited, causing the massive explosion and fire, were produced during the Korean War, Navy officials say it's constantly tested and highly stable. Some naval officers have theorized that the powder was ignited by hot debris left behind in the gun barrel from a previous firing. But Fleet Admiral Jerome Johnson, who was on board at the time, says this particular gun had not yet been fired.
The captain had given authorization to commence firing from gun turret 2, and that's when the explosion occurred.
Until more is known, the Navy has ordered a halt to firing any of the 16-inch guns on the Navy's four battleships. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
The jury in the Iran-Contra trial of Oliver North is expected to begin deliberations tomorrow. The jurors heard instructions from U.S. District Judge Gerhard Gesell today before being sequestered. Gesell said that only one of the 12 counts in the indictment against North, the charge that he shredded or altered National Security Council documents, requires that the jury find he had criminal intent in order to convict him. President Bush said today he has a clear conscience about his role in the Iran-Contra affair. He wouldn't comment directly on documents introduced in the trial of Oliver North that indicate that his involvement as vice president in the Reagan administration was greater than Bush has admitted. Soviet officials have denied the use of a nerve gas in quelling rioters 2 weeks ago in the Georgian capital of Tbilisi. We have a report from the BBC's Diana Goodman in Moscow.
The foreign ministry spokesman conceded that he was not an expert on the subject of poisonous gas, and he appeared not to be fully aware of the details already published by the official media. But he insisted the poison was nothing more than tear gas, and he said that was used in many countries when police or soldiers were compelled to bring a situation under control. However, the spokesman did not explain why, with ordinary tear gas, doctors had been forced to ask the country's leading toxicologists to try to identify the chemical, nor did he comment on the refusal by the military authorities in Tbilisi to provide hospitals with any information. He also carefully sidestepped questions about whether disciplinary action might be taken against the troops for having used poisonous gas against the crowd. A group of independent observers who traveled to Georgia to try to assess what really happened when the demonstration was broken up have already accused the authorities of applying rigid censorship and of blatantly distorting the facts.
Diana Goodman reporting on events in Soviet Georgia, where landslides and heavy flooding reportedly have killed more than 40 people. The TASS news agency says landslides occurred in a mountainous region close to the Turkish border. According to TASS, about 700 people have been evacuated. NATO ministers meeting in Brussels gave tacit approval to a plan proposed by Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, which would upgrade nuclear arms in Western Europe. Cheney says the plan would match modernization efforts made by the Warsaw Pact over the past 5 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost over 9.5 points to close at 2377.38. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Country music fans, rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of four new albums that he says are worth listening to. They feature the talents of women singers and songwriters like Gail Davies.
That would suit me fine. Wanna hear what you think and what you've got on your mind, 'cause I know it's just a matter of time.
The people who market country music have always been eager to latch onto any sort of trend or artistic movement that will attract an audience beyond the usual core of country listeners. A decade ago, for example, there were the so-called Outlaws, led by Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings. Their unifying traits seemed to be that they made good music and wore their hair longer than was fashionable in country music circles back then. More recently, there's been the neo-traditionalist or hardcore country movement, with people like Randy Travis and Dwight Yoakam becoming big stars in the process. So I'm a little surprised that no one seems to have noticed a new, loose coalition of country performers, all of them women, and all of them creating fresh variations on traditional country music. The person I think of as the center of this unacknowledged movement is Gail Davies, who's made 8 albums and had her songs recorded by many other singers over the past decade. Davies' new album is called Pretty Words, and the title is a bit sarcastic. There's more than just mere prettiness to her words, and the melodies have a tart, astringent quality that render them more than just catchy tunes. This is true of a song such as Waiting Here for You.
I still believe that someday, baby, we will love again.
Gail Davies once said in an interview, quote, "When I first came to Nashville in 76, it was very difficult to make my music the way I heard it. The industry wasn't open to a woman having much to say about the production, the sound. But lately I see a lot of women in country who are getting involved in the making of their albums." One of the women Davies must have had in mind is Wendy Waldman. Waldman had a cult following in the 70s for her own L.A. pop singer-songwriter albums. But in the 80s, she relocated to Nashville to work mostly behind the scenes, writing songs for a lot of artists, and doing some production work. Waldman has written one of the strongest songs, for example, on the debut album by Laurie Yates. Yates is a young country singer from Toronto. Her album is called Can't Stop the Girl, and the Wendy Waldman song she's singing here is called How Much Does It Take? That's Laurie Yates. I think it's common to think of most of the great women in country music as having been interpreters of other people's songs. That was certainly true of everyone from Patsy Cline and Kitty Wells to Tammy Wynette and Emmylou Harris. Loretta Lynn and Dolly Parton, who wrote their own greatest hits, were more the exception than the rule. Even today, a top female act like the mother-daughter team The Judds writes very little of their own material. But a couple of very strong new singers are equally good as writers. There is, for example, Karen Staley, who's written every song on her debut album, Wildest Dreams.
Well, you make it so easy to take another chance. Open up my heart and gamble on romance. I wanna be there every
that's Karen Staley. Another strong singer and songwriter, Mary Chapin Carpenter, is based in Washington, D.C. Carpenter's new album, State of the Heart, contains 10 originals that stake her claim as one of the most intelligent and distinctive of current country singers.
No one's gotta tell me it's over. I could see it from miles away. No one's gotta tell me what I don't already know today. No one's gotta tell me they've seen you on the town with an old girlfriend. No one's gotta tell me you look like you've fallen in love again. 'Cause you're out of my life now with a wave of her hand. You never had it so good, babe. I never had it so bad. Now you can do what you want to and never feel sad. You never had it so good, babe. I never had it so bad.
That's Mary Chapin Carpenter. Ken Ducker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in today for Terry Gross. Coming up, we'll hear her interview with screenwriter and director Cameron Crowe. In the new movie, Say Anything, Cameron Crowe returns to the teen years, the setting of his first career triumph. Say Anything is a teen movie about an aspiring kickboxer named Lloyd Dobler and his mismatched love affair with an intelligent, attractive high school senior who will soon leave for England on a prestigious fellowship. Lloyd's friends, who fear he's out of his league, try to talk him out of the relationship. Cameron Crowe is best known for his first book, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and for his screenplay of the hit movie that launched the careers of Sean Penn and Judge Reinhold. Terry asked Cameron Crowe to describe the Lloyd Dobler character in Say Anything.
Well, Lloyd is a kickboxer, which is, you know, you have to understand, I guess, sports a little bit to know what a lost cause sport that really is. It's like your glory comes at 3 a.m. on ESPN if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are guys that work at Denny's until about 5 o'clock on the day they fight, you know. And then he was based on a guy that moved in down the street from me who would just lose every fight, you know, but he'd just be right there punching on the bag the next morning. You know, I'm going to win the next one. So I just loved writing this character, Lloyd Dobler, who was in love with this girl, and, you know, he wasn't the smartest guy in the world, on paper maybe, and everyone said, you don't deserve a girl like that, or how can you be a kickboxer, and he just kind of forges ahead as this warrior for optimism, and he has his own rhythms, you know, he grew up an army brat, and so he has this odd formality about him too, so it's just fun to write these long patches of dialogue that are like, sir, I just want to tell you a little bit about myself, sir. I'll tell you this. I am a kickboxer. I'm a scientific kickboxer. You know,
I don't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything as a career. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed, or buy anything sold or processed, or process anything sold, bought, or processed, or repair anything sold, bought, or processed. You know, as a career, I don't want to do that. So my father's in the Army. He wants me to join, but I can't work for that corporation. So what I've been doing lately is kickboxing, which is a new sport, but I think it's got a good future.
So he's a character who falls in love with a girl who he thinks is kind of out of his league. She's very smart, yeah. Very beautiful. Did you relate to that?
Well, I usually get turned down by girls like that, but not Lloyd. I'll tell you why it was fun to write, and the basic difference between this and Fast Times is that this is more about love, and Fast Times was a lot about the awkward messiness of first-time sex, you know? And especially, you know, I wanted to write in Fast Times about kids becoming adults at younger and younger ages, which really struck me. And about 8 years ago, it was just starting to break, all these kids in fast food jobs and supporting their lifestyles at 15. And I wanted to get past that and write about what happens when, you know, you've assumed this, quote, adult existence, unquote, at a young age, and then all of a sudden you get broadsided by a whole new set of emotions, namely real love.
Say Anything is the first film that you directed. Was it an ambition of yours to direct? How did you get to direct this?
I just always wanted to be a writer, and directing this was an outgrowth of wanting to protect the script, really, and I was lucky enough that they asked me. And so I felt like I exchanged the terror of seeing the script fall into the hands of someone that would condescend to the young characters, you know, exchanging the terror of that with the absolute terror of doing it myself, you know.
Right.
So
you wanted to protect the script, but when you were directing it yourself, did you find yourself furiously rewriting it once you were on the set?
There was a writer's strike on at the time, so I am like Mr. Rewrite. I will rewrite anything. I will rewrite, you know, phone messages. I will do it all, but I couldn't when we were doing this movie. And so I had to work from about 8 drafts that we had of this script. And John Mahoney, who plays the father in the movie, I was very lucky to be working with him because John Mahoney memorized every draft. So he would say, gee, this isn't quite working here. Why don't we go back to something in draft 3? I'm going, whoa, what was in draft 3? And he'd peel off this great speech and I wouldn't even remember writing it, you know?
It's funny that there was a writer's strike. That meant that half of you was on strike and half of you wasn't.
It was kind of a joke. you know, people would say, this line isn't working. What are we going to do? And I'd have to say, well, the writer's on strike. You know, we're in trouble. But they, you know, they told me there were spies around and things like that, so not to not to rewrite.
A lot of
and I supported the strike, so, you know.
A lot of directors say that casting is about the most crucial decision that you make in a movie. Do you agree with that? And if so, let's talk about the casting.
Yes, and okay.
Okay. Well, you cast John Cusack in the role of Lloyd Dobler, who's the aforementioned character that you described. What did you want him for the role?
I wanted him because of... Did you ever see Stand By Me?
No, I'm one of the few people who missed it.
Well, if you ever see Stand By Me, there is a little flashback of John Cusack as the older brother of, I think, Will Wheaton's character. And it's just, you know, it's this quiet moment, and he's sitting at a table. He doesn't have the pressure on him to be the funny man or to carry the weight of all the humor or to be the charming guy. He's just simply acting. But I always remembered that this was such an affecting moment, and he was never allowed to really be natural in any of the movies that he made that were so-called teen movies. And he felt the same way, of course, and you know, he's getting into leading man land now. He looks different. He looks older. He's like a beefier, tough-looking guy. And he wasn't sure if he could go back and play a younger character. He'd already played a 26-year-old in 8 Men Out.
Ione Skye is very beautiful, very sensual, and she plays a character who's the smartest girl in the school and is also very humble and very shy. And I have to tell you that there's something I had problems with in the casting in the casting of her.
Go ahead.
And that is, it's been my experience watching movies that girls who are supposed to maybe be a little plain and a little shy are always cast as being gorgeous and sensual.
I know.
I think we're in this kind of crisis in movies where men and boys are allowed to be a little offbeat looking, but leading ladies just really aren't.
I would love to talk to you about this.
Uh-huh.
Because I think Ione really is on the scale of leading ladies. I think Ione, you know, is very real looking. You know, it's just, maybe that's just my opinion, but it's funny when you get into the position of directing a movie and there are studio people telling you, you know, the things you probably shouldn't listen to. Ultimately, I didn't listen to them, but they all wanted this much more overt, quote, beautiful girl, you know? And I felt Ione was a realistic beauty, you know? I thought, plus the movie's set in Seattle, and I thought she looked a little bit like a Seattle girl. And, you know, there are some offbeat things about her. She did have to play a gorgeous girl in the script, but, you know, I really agree with what you say in that characters should be allowed to be realistic looking and not these master race, you know, gorgeous guys or girls.
Yeah.
And plus mm-hmm. she's 17.
Yeah.
And I wanted to cast a 17-year-old for the part.
Mm-hmm. I think that demographic research is really plaguing the movie industry now. And I would guess that it's particularly bad with high school movies, since movie executives don't really know what high school students are interested in or what kind of movie they'd like to see.
Boy, they probably, is that the truth.
Yeah, so were you stuck with having to do a lot of market research to see what a high school audience might respond to?
Oh, yes. They really believe in these numbers. And ultimately, I think you have to listen to the numbers and then throw these pieces of paper away, because I heard some fairly chilling stuff in the course of finishing this movie. And I have to tell you, none of the movies that these guys said were going to be huge were huge, and all of the movies that they trashed, to me personally, ended up being received, you know, soulful movies, for example, ended up being received by the audience much more than their numbers told them. So I think what it all comes down to is people are always smarter than you give them credit for being, particularly kids. And there was thought that this movie didn't have enough car crashes and didn't have enough, you know, overt sex and stuff. And then to see, you know, people lining up for the movie on opening night was a pretty wonderful thing, because I believe that, you know, there have been enough of those movies. There have been enough Porky's movies, you know?
On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross talks with Cameron Crowe about infiltrating a Southern California high school to research Fast Times at Ridgemont High. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and co-host Robert Siegel has joined us. Hi, Robert. What news do you have on the Iowa?
Well, we'll be hearing from David Mulpis, Marty, who's covering the story and telling us everything we do know about what might have gone wrong on the battleship to have caused the explosion. We'll also be hearing from Nina Totenberg about the North trial, which is now, I believe, with the jury, and a story about the Soviet Union, saying that perhaps gas was used, toxic gas, on demonstrators in Soviet Georgia last week. That charge has been disputed by officials in Moscow now. And what was behind the riots in Jordan?
Okay. Those stories and more are coming up from National Public Radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff has seen Cameron Crowe's new movie, Say Anything, and he has this review.
The boy has just graduated, and he doesn't know what to do with his life. The girl is way too good for him, beautiful and brilliant and zealously protected by her doting father. But he loves her, and she reluctantly falls for him. And by the end, we in the audience badly want them to be together, even though we know their relationship can never really work. Sound familiar? Of course. That's the plot of Mike Nichols' 1967 landmark film, The Graduate. But it's also the plot of Say Anything, and, crazy as it may sound, Say Anything is the better movie. The writer Cameron Crowe has never directed before, and he doesn't have Mike Nichols' bag of chic tricks to rely on. But he's come up with a terrific and terrifically funny script. And he also has a wonderful idea. If you're going to make a high school romance, why leave out the parents? Say Anything is actually a romantic triangle. The girl, Diane, and the two men who adore her, young Lloyd, whom she scarcely knows, and her single father, Jim, who wants only what's best for Diane and knows that Lloyd isn't it. The rivals meet when Lloyd shows up to take Diane out on their first date.
Hi, Lloyd Dalbus, sir.
Oh.
Pleasure to meet you.
Hello, Lloyd.
Hello. Look, I know you're busy, you don't have to entertain me, but you can trust me. I'll tell you a couple things about myself. I'm 19. I've been overseas for a couple semesters. Now I'm back. I'm an athlete, so I rarely drink. I quit kickboxing. You ever heard of kickboxing? Sport of the future? Don the Dragon Wilson, Benny the Jet Urquidez, Murray Smith, some of the champions of the sport. I can see by your face, no. My point is you can relax because your daughter will be safe with me for the next 7 to 8 hours, sir.
That's John Cusack doing the fast talking as Lloyd, and his performance is absolutely lovely. His Lloyd isn't a jock, and he isn't a nerd, and he isn't any other sort of high school stereotype. He's beyond pigeonholing. What Cusack shows us immediately is that Lloyd is capable of love, that he knows how to care for someone, and that his ambition to be a kickboxer is not really the measure of his true aspirations. His love for Diane is. Cusack, in short, is at once scruffy and noble, much in the way that Dustin Hoffman was in The Graduate. But where The Graduate caricatured its supporting characters, say anything burrows into them. As Diane, Ione Skye shows us all the cultish indecision and uncertainty knocking around inside the gorgeous overachiever. And as her father, John Mahoney gives a wonderfully touching performance. His adoration for his daughter isn't erotic, but it has its dark side. And his desolation when that dark side is revealed is overpowering. Crow's dialogue is buoyant and slangy, without being show-offy, and his actors deliver meanings between and around the lines. One feels intimate with them right away, and that intimacy never lets up. And if Crow isn't yet a directorial stylist, he's also not afraid to give us complex party sequences and tableaus of high school life that are beautifully detailed and satisfying. In Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Crow showed that he remembered high school with 20/20 hindsight. But Say Anything goes way beyond that. The characters are as rich and pleasing as any we've seen this year. The turmoil they undergo is genuinely compelling. Say Anything may be a kid's movie, but it's much more than a movie for kids.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Terry Gross continues her discussion with Cameron Crowe, who wrote and directed the new film, Say Anything. We'll find out how he managed to get through an entire year of high school without anyone discovering he was actually an undercover journalist. Also, poet Gregory Janikian reads from his latest collection titled Falling Deeply into America. And Cajun musician Michael Doucette joins us in our weekly performance spot. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Ed Dougherty, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Deborah Beagle and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in today for Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.